So this talk is a kind of a survey talk, trying to compress several papers, developments in the general topic of the transcendence of special values of L-series, which is apropos with the theme of this particular conference. So here's the general problem. Given a zeta function, yes? Pardon me? Okay. Given a zeta function L of s, what are the special values L of k when k is an integer? This is the general question. And the first question that I'd like to address is whether these special values are transcendental numbers. The second question is if these special values have a nice factorization into some sort of algebraic or arithmetic part and a transcendental part. And the third part of the investigation is to discuss the algebraic part and the action of Galois on the algebraic part. So let's begin with the prototypical of all zeta functions, the Riemann zeta function. So here's Riemann. So the Riemann zeta function is defined as a Dirichlet series, summation 1 over n to the s in the half-plane real part s bigger than 1. In his celebrated paper of 1859, Riemann derived an analytic continuation and functional equation for this function and indicated the importance of its study in the distribution of prime numbers. So here's the functional equation that Riemann had proved. I've put it deliberately in its asymmetric form because when we try to investigate special values, the asymmetric form is more useful than the symmetric form. So here's some quick survey of the special values of the Riemann zeta function. Euler was the first to investigate the special values. He proved that zeta 2n is essentially pi to the 2n times a rational number, the rational number being given by essentially a Bernoulli number. The Bernoulli numbers are rational numbers given by the generating function z over e to z minus 1. And by long division, you see easily that b sub n's are rational numbers. So here, the special value can then be factored as pi to the 2n. That's the transcendental part. And then the arithmetic part would be this b sub 2n over 2n factorial. And then we'd like to say something interesting about the arithmetic part, and we'd like to say something about the transcendental part. Another way to say the same theorem is that zeta minus n is minus b sub n plus 1 over n plus 1. So with this particular formulation, you see that zeta minus n is a rational number given by essentially the n plus first Bernoulli number. And using the asymmetric form of the functional equation, you easily derive the Euler's theorem. What about the odd values, the values of odd arguments? The values of zeta 2k plus 1 are still quite a mystery. Apéry shocked the world in 1978 by proving that zeta 3 is irrational, and after almost 20 years, Revol showed that infinitely many of these special values are irrational. So that was a great achievement. There are more results in that, but I think I'll just stop there. Let's now move on to Dirichlet L functions and discuss special values of Dirichlet L functions. So here's a picture of Dirichlet. So for any complex valued character chi modulo q, define L as chi as follows. Summation chi of n over n to the s is L s chi, and this Dirichlet series converges absolutely for real part of s bigger than 1. It converges conditionally for real part of s bigger than 0 when chi is a non-trivial character, and Dirichlet introduced these L series to show that there are infinitely many primes in a given arithmetic progression. And in 1880, so Dirichlet was not able to get the analytic continuation and functional equation to the entire complex plane. This was done much later by Hurwitz in 1880. He introduced the Hurwitz zeta function, and through the study of the Hurwitz zeta function managed to deduce the analytic continuation and functional equation of LS chi to the entire complex plane. So let me say a few words about the Hurwitz zeta function. The Hurwitz zeta function is defined as summation 1 over m plus q to the power s. Hurwitz derived the analytic continuation and functional equation of the zeta sq using theta series, very much similar to Riemann's original approach, but he had to use theta functions of two variables. One can write the classical Dirichlet L-theory, LS chi, as a linear combination of these Hurwitz zeta functions, and thereby, once you have the analytic continuation of Hurwitz zeta functions, you get for free the analytic continuation and functional equation for LS chi. Now, the interesting thing is, if you had the functional equation for the Hurwitz zeta function, it's not completely easy to see the beautiful and elegant shape of the functional equation for LS chi from that. You have to do a little bit of work, but it can be done. What's happened? I'm not getting anything. No. Okay. Good. I don't know what happened here. Let's go back here. Okay, try it. Okay, try this again. Okay, so we just did this. I wonder why that happened. Okay. Okay, let's look at special values of Dirichlet L series. Recall that a character chi is called even if chi of minus 1 is 1, and it's called odd if chi of minus 1 is minus 1. And the study of special values of classical Dirichlet L series now partitions itself into two groups, well, according as chi is even or chi is odd. So if k and chi have the same parity, then LK chi is an algebraic multiple of pi to the k. That can be shown very easily. If k and chi have opposite parity, then the nature of LK chi is still a mystery. Just like the zeta function at odd arguments. Nishimoto, in a paper that was posted in the archive, has shown that if chi is even, then infinitely many of the values L2K plus 1 chi are irrational, very much like Revol's theorem in the context of Dirichlet L series. And if chi is odd, then infinitely many of L2k chi are irrational. Let me explain a beautiful conjecture in the theory of Hurwitz special values of Hurwitz zeta functions enunciated by Chawla and Milner. So here's Chawla. Here's Milner. Their conjecture is fix k bigger than or equal to 2 and q bigger than or equal to 2, then the special values zeta k a over q are linearly independent over the rationals. So that's their conjecture. Very simple, very elegant and beautiful conjecture, very innocent looking conjecture, but as you will see, it has tremendous consequences. So what are the consequences of the Chawla-Milner conjecture? Well, this is joint work with my two Indian postdocs, Shaoli Gun and Purushottam Rath, who are here in the audience. The Chawla-Milner conjecture holds for q equals 4 if and only if zeta 2k plus 1 over pi the 2k plus 1 is irrational for every k greater than or equal to 1. So you can just see that the irrationality of zeta 2k plus 1 over pi the 2k plus 1 is equivalent to the Chawla-Milner conjecture in the special case q equals 4. Amazing. Of course, it is suspected that zeta 3, for example, is not a rational multiple of pi cubed, but no one's been able to prove that yet. And if you now assume the Chawla-Milner conjecture for all k and all q, then that implies that zeta 2k plus 1 over pi over 2k plus 1 squared is irrational for all k. So these are remarkable consequences of the Chalmers conjecture, which indicate the depth of the conjecture and the difficulty. Now, can we prove anything unconditional? Well, this is what we could manage. The Chalmers conjecture holds either for q equals 3 or for q equals 4. So we just missed it by that much, as Maxwell Smart would say, part number one. So this led us to formulate what we call a strong Chalmers conjecture. Strong Chalmers conjecture is to include 1 into the picture. So now we look at all these special values of the Hurwitz zeta function, zeta k, a over q, along with the number 1, and we expect that all these numbers are linearly independent over the rationals. And if you assume that, then in joint work with my two postdocs, zeta k is irrational if and only if the strong Chalmers-Milner conjecture is true, either for q equals 3 or q equals 4. So you can see that the irrationality of zeta k is intimately tied up with the strong Chalmers-Milner conjecture. So here are my postdocs. Oops, sorry. Oh, what happens? This time the escape button is not working. Do you know how to fix it? Oh, okay. Now the escape button has worked. Let's just see. Go back to the slide that I'm supposed to. Okay, so let's. There, okay. Use. So okay, this goes back. So those are my postdocs. Okay, now that was my old office. Okay, now in order to investigate more special values, we need to study what are called multiple gamma functions. These are the generalizations of the classical gamma function. The multiple gamma functions are defined recursively in the following fashion. Gamma sub m plus 1 of z plus 1 is gamma of m plus 1 of z divided by gamma m of z. And we initialize everything by declaring gamma 0 of z to be 1 over z. So notice that if you, in the case of gamma sub 1, you get that gamma sub 1 of z plus 1 is z gamma of z. That's the classical gamma function. So gamma sub 1 is the classical gamma function. And then gamma sub 2 is a Barnes gamma function, and gamma sub 3 are these higher gamma functions. So we have, one can show that 1 over gamma sub m of z extends to an entire function of order m and has an explicit Hadamard factorization. So gamma sub 2 of z was first studied by Barnes in 1900, and it's sometimes denoted by g of z. And one has a Hadamard factorization for g of z plus 1 is 2 pi to the power z over 2. That doesn't look like a z, but it is. Exponential minus z plus 1 plus gamma z squared over 2 times this product 1 plus z over n e to the minus z plus z squared over 2n. It's a little bit more complicated than the Hadamard factorization for the classical gamma function because gamma sub 2 of z is a function of order 2. So here are some conjectures and results related to the multiple gamma functions. So in the classical case, we know that gamma sub 1 of a half is square root of pi, so it's a transcendental number, and we expect that gamma sub m of a half to be transcendental for every m. That's a conjecture we're making. In fact, we expect that the number gamma sub m of a half should be algebraically independent. There's some rationale for that. And the context, I mean, the implication of these conjectures, in this context at least, what can we prove, whether can we prove that these numbers are transcendental or not? Well, the best we could come up with is that the number zeta 3 over pi cubed squared is irrational, or the number gamma 2 of a half divided by gamma 3 of a half is transcendental. So one of these two. So it's interesting that you can at least make some statements about the numbers that we know nothing about. In the context of the Chawla-Milner conjecture, I'd like to discuss now the relationship with multiple zeta values. So let me give you a quick crash course on multiple zeta values. So the multiple zeta function is defined as summation 1 over n1 to the a1, nk to the ak, with the n1s, n1 bigger than n2, bigger than nk. By the way, these zeta functions can be studied as functions of several complex variables, and one could derive analytic continuations for them. There are no functional equations for these multiple zeta values, zeta functions, and one could, of course, just like in the Riemann zeta function case, study special values, and similarly in this case too, we will now look at these special values. You have to be a little careful with a1 being equal to 1, but if you bar that and you allow for the ais to be non-negative integers and study these values, zeta a1 to ak, with the a1 to ak being m, you can see that there are only finitely many such values, and you look at the vector space spanned by these values, and you call that vector space V sub m, it's a finite dimensional vector space. Zagier made a conjecture about the dimension of this vector space. Let D sub m be the dimension of V sub m over Q, and let's initialize this sequence of numbers D sub m by declaring D sub 0 to be 1 and D sub 1 to be 0. As you can see, V sub 0 and V sub 1 don't really make any sense, therefore we just set things up in this fashion. And now for m bigger than or equal to 2, you said D sub m should satisfy this recursion relation, D sub m minus 2 plus D sub m minus 3. That's a very simple second-order recursion relation, and you can use power series or whatnot to deduce that the dimension d sub m, you can actually derive an explicit formula in terms of the associated cubic equation that you get, and you see immediately that d sub m grows exponentially. Oh, okay. Okay, start from m equals 3 then. And d sub 2 we will, of course, have. It's just 1. D sub 2 is just the vector space spanned by zeta 2. There's no other way. Now, what's interesting is, even though the dimensions d sub m grow exponentially, not a single value of m is known where d sub m is bigger than 1. So it's kind of an interesting thing. And by the way, in this context, let me point out that Terasoma, Goncharov, and Delin have shown that the conjecture of Zagier for the dimension d sub m, the formula that you would get for d sub m by solving this recursion is an upper bound for the dimension of d sub m. That much has been proved. And that just comes from looking at what are called shuffle and stuffle relations amongst the zeta functions, and writing down all the possible relations that you can have between these special values, and saying that there are no further relations, and then computing what the dimension of the vector space would be. So now let's go back to this value. Let's go back to the LK chi, the Dirichlet L series, and let's look at the value at L1 chi, because I want to come back to the significance of the multiple zeta values in this context. So using Gauss sums, one can evaluate L1 chi explicitly as an algebraic linear combination of logarithms of algebraic numbers. In fact, if you want to be precise, you take chi a primitive character, you use Gauss sums, and you write tau chi times L1 chi star to be summation chi of A log of 1 minus zeta to the a, where zeta is a primitive cube root of unity, and tau of chi is a Gauss sum. Tau of chi is a sum of certain roots of unity, therefore it's an algebraic number, and so you see that essentially what we have on the right-hand side is a linear form in logarithms. So it's interesting. No, it doesn't matter. It's for any chi. Yeah. That's true. It'll come out of that. It does come out of the wash if you do it carefully. Yeah. This derivation is universal and it applies to both even and odd characters. Yeah. So the interesting thing is that if you replace 1 minus zeta to the a by log of 1 minus zeta to the a by log of 1 minus zeta to the a over 1 minus zeta, you haven't done anything because summation chi of a is 0. So the right-hand side is not only a linear combination of logarithms of algebraic numbers, but it's actually logarithms of units in the cyclotomic field. And so this point of view is going to be important for what I want to say later on with respect to Stark's conjectures. Now let's recall Baker's theorem. Here's Alan Baker. Baker's theorem says that if you have non-zero algebraic numbers alpha 1 to alpha n, such that log alpha 1 to log alpha n are linearly independent over the rationals, then 1 and log alpha 1 to log alpha n are linearly independent over the field of algebraic numbers. The one striking consequence of this beautiful theorem is that if you have a linear form in logarithms of algebraic numbers with algebraic coefficients, then it's either zero or transcendental. That's what you can get from this particular theorem. And in our context, we immediately deduce that Baker's theorem shows that L1 chi is transcendental. And I don't think one would know this, that L1 chi is transcendental before Baker's theorem, I would think, even though we knew the value of L1 chi. Except in the, as he points out in the, in exactly in that case. Now, let me bring in Shanuel's conjecture to perhaps set the stage for more general context. So suppose x1 to xn are linearly independent numbers over the rationals. Now, they don't have to be algebraic numbers. Just x1 to xn are linearly independent over the rational numbers. Then the conjecture of Shanuel is that the transcendence degree of the field K, where K is the field generated by x1 to xn, e to the x1 to e to the xn, the transcendence degree of this field is at least n. And it turns out that Shanuel's conjecture, a small exercise, implies the following strengthening of Baker's theorem. If log alpha 1 to log alpha n are linearly independent over the rationals, then they're algebraically independent over the field of algebraic numbers. So the theorem that we could prove, here are some interesting consequences of Shanuel's conjecture. So going back to the earlier theorems that I had already said, if you assume Shanuel's conjecture, then you can prove the following theorem. Either zeta 3 and pi are algebraically independent, or the multiple gamma 2 of a half divided by gamma 3 of a half is a transcendental number. So it's at least something interesting that you can say about, probably both assertions are correct, but at the moment we can only say one or the other. And remember that in the earlier slide I told you that we could prove unconditionally only that zeta 3 over pi cubed squared is either irrational or this multiple gamma value at a half is transcendental. Now let me try to bring back the discussion on L1 chi and L1 rho in general with respect to ART and L series, so give you a quick crash course on ART and L functions. The Frobenius automorphism and the Artin symbol. So what are these? So let K be an algebraic number field and consider a finite Galois extension F over K with group G. And for each place of K, let W be a place of F lying above V, and let sigma sub W be the Frobenius automorphism at W, which is well-defined modulo inertia at W. And as one ranges over the places W above a fixed place V, the sigma W's describe a conjugacy class in the group, in the Galois group. And this conjugacy class is called the Artin symbol and denoted by sigma sub V. In the case of an abelian extension, the Artin symbol is a group element because all the conjugacy classes are singletons. So here's a the definition of an Artinel series, if you give me a complex linear representation of the Galois group G, rho G going to GLV, where V is d-dimensional vector space over the complex numbers, we define the Artinel function as LS rho. It's a function attached to three pieces of data. One is the complex variable S, second is the representation rho, and the third is F over K, the field, the relative field extension. It's defined as the determinant of the linear transformation rho of sigma sub V, where here, for each V, we just pick sigma W in the conjugacy class, and that's well defined because we're just talking about the characteristic polynomial. Two matrices which are conjugate have the same characteristic polynomial, so this is a well-defined thing. And this V sub I, or V to the power I, means basically the subfield fixed by the inertia group. Sometimes we may just denote this L function by LS rho, and it's not difficult to see that the product converges absolutely for real part of S bigger than 1 and is analytic in this region. And it's also clear that if rho is a sum of two representations, rho 1 plus rho 2, then LS rho is simply LS rho 1 times LS rho 2. Sorry, I forgot the LS rho there. LS rho equals LS rho 1 times LS rho 2. So Artinel series should be thought of as generalizations of Dirichlet-L series. Of course, it's still an open problem about the analytic continuation and showing these L functions are entire. I'll come to that in a second. If K is a field of rational numbers and F is the Qth cyclotomic field, then Galois F over K is isomorphic to the group of coprime residue classes mod Q. And the characters of this Galois group are precisely the Dirichlet characters, and the Artinel series attached to these characters are precisely Dirichlet's L series. And if 1 is a trivial representation, then LS1 is simply the Dedekind zeta function of the base field. So all the L series that we have come to know and love are packaged in the universe of Artinel series. Artin's famous conjecture is that if rho is an irreducible representation and non-trivial, then LS rho extends to an entire function. And Artin's reciprocity theorem is that this, if rho is one-dimensional, then there's a Hecke L series, L K S psi, such that LS rho is equal to L sub K S psi. Now Hecke, there's a part of a picture that I haven't been able to describe in this short talk. Hecke investigated L series attached to what are called Grossmann characters, and these L series extend to the entire complex plane and satisfy a beautiful functional equation just like the Riemann zeta function. So the theory of Hecke L series with respect to analytic continuation functional equation is well understood. The special values are not well understood, but analyticity is in some sense well understood. So in the case of rho being a one-dimensional Galois representation, we know that it's essentially the Artinel L series is essentially a Hecke L series. That's a very beautiful theorem. And it's called reciprocity because it includes all the classical reciprocity theorems like quadratic reciprocity, cubic reciprocity, and so on and so forth. So by virtue of the analytic continuation of Hecke L series, we derive Artin's conjecture in this case. And Brouwer induction theorem allows us to write any character as an integral linear combination of inductions of one-dimensional characters. And so Artin's reciprocity law combined with Brouwer's induction theorem allows us to derive the mirror morphic continuation of any of the Artinel series. So these L series also satisfy a functional equation relating S to 1 minus S. So what about two-dimensional representations? Well, for two-dimensional representations, there's been remarkable progress by Chandrasekhar Kare and Vinton Bourget. And their theorem is that if rho is a two-dimensional odd representation, that is, the determinant of rho of C, where C is complex conjugation, is minus 1, then LS rho is equal to LS pi for some automorphic form on associated to GL2 of the Adel ring of the number field of K. That's a beautiful theorem, and Kare and Winterberger were awarded the Cole Prize earlier this year for this remarkable theorem of the 21st century. So let me now try to tell you a little bit about the generalization of Dirichlet's class, Dirichlet's formula, it's not the class number formula, is the Dirichlet's formula for L1 chi that I talked about earlier in the context of ART and L series. And this is Stark's conjecture. So there's Harold Stark. There are numbers, algebraic numbers W of chi with absolute value 1 and theta of chi such that L1 chi is given by W of chi 2 to the a, pi to the b, theta of chi times r of chi, where r of chi is the determinant of a regulator matrix whose entries are linear forms and logarithms of units in the ring of integers of f. So this is the conjecture. This is not a theorem. This is the beautiful conjecture which kind of mimics the formula that we saw in the classical case of Dirichlet L series, L1 chi being written as a linear form in logarithms of units. Similarly, Stark conjectures that for a non-abelian L function, the ART and L series L1 chi should be exactly of the same shape. But there has to be some power of pi times this determinant of a matrix whose entries are linear forms in logarithms, and the rest of the stuff is again algebraic. W of chi is algebraic, 2 to the a is algebraic. Theta of chi is algebraic. Theta of chi is algebraic. See, I said there are algebraic numbers, W of chi and theta of chi. Yeah, theta of chi is algebraic. And then Stark goes on to describe Galois action on these things too, but that's let's not get into that now. Yeah, so it'll be like a root number, exactly, yes. So now the transcendence of L1 chi is something that we cannot deduce immediately from Baker's theorem, because Baker's theorem is unable to say that. But if you take Shanuel's conjecture and realize that Shanuel's conjecture implies that logarithms of algebraic numbers, once they're linearly independent over Q, are linearly independent over Q bar, that's Baker's theorem. But Shanuel would imply that they're algebraically independent over Q bar. And that if you take that into account, you can immediately see that L1 chi F over K is transcendental. If chi is a rational character, now how does this work? Here's how this works. If chi is a rational character, then by Brouwer induction, you can write your character as an integer linear combination of inductions of the trivial character. And the ART and L series corresponding to the trivial character is really the Dedekind zeta function of the corresponding base field. And when we're talking about the special value of the Dedekind zeta function at round 1, we're really meaning the residue. And so, in the context of L1 chi, when chi is a rational character, you can write it as a product of these residues of the Dedekind zeta functions, which would have these regulator terms and linear forms and logarithms and determinants of these things. And so, pasting all that together and doing a careful job, you can deduce the transcendence of this number. How do you get the same theorem in the general case of an arbitrary character, not necessarily a rational character? Well, then we don't have this wonderful, you know, reduction to the Dedekind zeta function case. We have to kind of assume Stark's conjecture and assume that these things are. We know the shape of those special values, and then we and get that it's transcendental. So that's basically how the proof of this theorem works. Now, what about ART and L series at integer arguments? Once you have, every time you're given an L series, at least in the context of this conference, the central question should be, what can you say about special values, and can you get your hands on these special values? Well, in the Dedekind zeta function case, in the Riemann zeta function case, and in the classical Dirichlet L series case, we learned that Euler's method, generalized, works for half of the special values. So the natural question that occurs to anyone who meets the ART and L function for the first time is there an Euler-type theorem for an ART and L series? So the question really is, linked with the representation, how the representation decomposes in terms of it's plus eigenspace and minus eigenspace. So given an Artin representation rho, you always have the action of complex conjugation, which is an automorphism of order 2. So the vector space under this action will decompose into the plus eigenspace and the minus eigenspace, and we will denote v plus as the plus eigenspace and v minus as the minus eigenspace. And we will say that the dimension, the representation rho, will have Hodge type A comma B if the plus eigenspace has dimension A and the minus eigenspace has dimension B. No, this is a representation over a complex linear representation. G is a Galois group of a relative number field. No. Base field is an algebraic number field. There's no restriction to Q, no. And that's important, that we don't restrict ourselves to Q. We don't want to do that. So the precise nature of the special value LK rho F over K will depend on partly on the Hodge type A comma B. So I just want to associate this pair. And the Siegel-Klingon theorem of 1962 kind of attacks this question for the first time relatively recently as 1962. It may not be recent for other people in the room, but certainly I was alive at that time. So Siegel and Klingon prove the following beautiful theorem. Let K be a totally real field, then the special value zeta K 2n is a rational multiple of pi to the 2n times this degree K over Q. So it's a power of pi, and the power is 2n times the degree of the extension. Beautiful theorem. And a good place to study the proof of this theorem, in my opinion, is the Tata Institute lecture notes on advanced analytic number theory by Siegel, and they have an appendix at the very end where, thank goodness, this paper originally written in German has been translated into English. So it's a good place to study it for some of us who don't know German. You're off the hook. So, and the interesting thing about the proof is it uses the theory of Hilbert modular forms, and again, it's a good place for people who want to study modular forms to see how knowledge of Hilbert modular forms also helps you in the knowledge of modular forms. It's a beautiful, beautiful proof. And if I get a chance, I'll try to give it in the course on modular forms that I'm giving at Queen's in the fall term. So it's really worth studying. And it's the tip of the iceberg because, as I said, the Dedekind zeta function is only a special case of the Artin L series universe. So the people who asked the question, what is the analog of Euler's theorem in the context of an Artin L series, the first two people that have asked this question, believe it or not, were Coates and Lichtenbaum. And their theorem of 1973 more or less spells everything out. So what is their theorem? The theorem is the following. As I said, sometimes when you try to study these special values, it might be easier to study the special value at the negative integers first, and then apply the functional equation and then get information of the positive. So suppose that L minus n rho is not zero. So this is, for those of you who know Dillon's philosophy of this thing, it basically means suppose that n is critical. So L minus n rho is an algebraic number lying in the field generated over Q by the values of the character of rho. Isn't that a beautiful theorem? That's the simplest way of stating the generalization of Euler's theorem for Artin L series. So L minus n rho is really an algebraic number. It lies in the field generated by the values of the character of rho. It doesn't even depend on the representation. Yeah, that's true. It's under that for the critical value, exactly. And you have an algebraic, beautiful algebraic number, and the Galois action on this algebraic number is given by L minus n rho acted on by sigma is equal to L minus n rho sigma. It's a, you know, you take a representation, you can act on it by sigma, so you have this beautiful Galois action on it. No, I'll come to that. That's the rest of my talk. Okay. So this means that if the Hodge type, so what does it mean, as you say, point out, L minus N rho is zero. What does it really mean in terms of, you know, so it means basically the Hodge type should either be A0 or 0B. It should, you know, it shouldn't be mixed. And that's where the problem lies. With this mixed Hodge types, there's going to be problems. And I'll come to that in a second. So if the Hodge type is A0, then L2K rho is an algebraic multiple of a power of pi by virtue of the functional equation. And if the Hodge type is 0B, then you get it for the odd guys. L2K plus 1 rho is an algebraic multiple of a power of pi. And you can spell out exactly what that algebraic multiple is. By the way, let me point out, I don't think the story on the Kolb-Schlittenbaum theorem is complete, because there's still a lot of interesting things to study about the coefficient, what algebraic multiple it is. We know a lot of information about Bernoulli numbers and their connection to class numbers of cyclotomic fields and so on and so forth, but there's a lot of stuff that's still not known about those coefficients that I think is worth investigating. So what about the mixed case of the situation when the Hodge type is mixed? Well, to say anything constructive and concrete, you have to discuss the polylogarithm. I go on until 3, don't I? Okay. So the polylogarithm is defined as the following power series. Lk of z is summation z to the n over n to k. And for k equals 1, I think everyone in this room can sum that and realize that it's minus log 1 minus z. And for k bigger than or equal to 2, the series converges in the closed disk, mod z less than or equal to 1. And one can show that these functions extend to the cut complex plane. You take the complex plane and you take off the strip from 1 to infinity, and it extends into that region. So that's a nice theorem in its own right. So you have this extension of the logarithm function. And the polylog conjecture that my colleagues from India and I have made is the following, that if alpha 1 to alpha n are algebraic numbers such that Lk of alpha 1 to Lk of alpha n are linearly independent over Q, then they're linearly independent over the field of algebraic numbers. This conjecture is motivated from several directions. The first direction is that it's a natural extension of Baker's theorem, of Baker's theorem from k equals 1. And the other motivation for making this conjecture is, I believe it's true in the function field context. The people who work on polylog function in the Grünfeld context. So let's now revisit the Chawla-Milner conjecture. The polylog conjecture, the generalization of Baker's theorem in the polylog context implies the Chawla-Milner conjecture for all Q and K. So that's the first, shows you that the polylog conjecture is very powerful and very difficult. By the way, I should point out that, if I can understand it, the polylog conjecture seems to be related to another conjecture of Balaam's, which is formulated in cohomological terms, which I haven't understood yet, but it looks to me that it's connected. So the other interesting thing about the Chawla-Milner conjecture is that it implies that the vector space spanned by these multiple zeta values of weight 4k plus 2 has q dimension at least 2. So there are two things here. The polylog conjecture implies the Chawla-Milner conjecture, and the Chawla-Milner conjecture actually implies that the vector space of these multiple zeta values has dimension at least 2 in this case. So remember, I said at the beginning that not a single case is really known where the dimension of the multiple zeta values is the space spanned by these multiple zeta values is dimension bigger than 1. So it goes to show that somehow the Chawla-Milner conjecture has something to say about that. So the Chawla-Milner conjecture is very hard. And I think the conjecture that the dimension of those vector spaces spanned by these multiple zeta values being bigger than 2, bigger than or equal to 2, is a hard conjecture. You have to show something's not rational, somehow, or or linearly independent over Q from the special values. Yeah. So let's go back to the Zagier's conjecture. So here's Zagier, who has turned 60 this year. So this is not the multiple zeta conjecture, but this is a conjecture about what the special value of an Artin L series should be. So what should the special value be? Well, the special value of an Artin L series, LK chi F over K, should be an algebraic multiple of a power of pi and R sub K of chi, where R sub K of chi is a determinant of matrix whose entries are now not linear forms and logarithms, but linear forms of polylogarithms evaluated at algebraic arguments. Now, I've simplified, Zagier has a little bit more precise conjecture than this, but I've simplified it for this talk. He also makes exact conjectures as what the power of pi should be. And now, here's the other interesting thing. I don't think the algebraic factor has been spelled out so clearly as it should be, because that'll be interesting to see from the context of the Galois action what the algebraic factor should be. The theorem that we have is if chi is 1, that is a trivial character, remember the trivial character corresponds to the Dedekind zeta function, in that case, and k is 2 and 3, then Zagier's conjecture is true. So what is this theorem saying? This theorem is saying that if you give me a Dedekind zeta function of a number field, any number field, and you plug in either 2 or 3 for the argument, then that special value can be written as a power of pi times a determinant of a matrix involving polylogs, either dilogarithm or the trilogarithm. That's basically what it says. It's a hard theorem. Yeah. So let's go back and revisit k equals 1. The case k equals 1 is interesting. So you see, once you understand Zagier's conjecture in this fashion, at least for me, the natural thing to do would be to search for cases where I can actually separate pi, the pi part, and I can also separate and get my hands on the determinant part. And if I'm lucky enough that the determinant part is actually linear forms and logarithms and not linear forms and polylogarithms, where I really don't know much about, then there's hope for proving more theorems. And there are some cases where the Artin L function special value does factor as a power of pi and linear form and logarithms. That case is the imaginary quadratic case. If K is an imaginary quadratic field and F is a Hilbert class field, then LK chi, where chi is a character of the ideal class group, is a special value of an Artin L function, and so one can show, for example, that these ideal class zeta functions have the property that LK chi is the same as LK chi star, and therefore the special value should be taken very carefully. So you look at the special values associated to the ideal class characters of the class group. And because you have this simple observation that LK1 chi is the same as LK1 chi bar, I didn't write chi bar because PowerPoint doesn't allow you to put a bar over that thing, so I had to use star. So LK1 chi is equal to LK1 chi bar, therefore they're the same values. So if you're trying to prove a linear independent statement, you should take up half of the values out of the picture, and that's what we do. And the set of values LK1 chi, then modulo this equivalence, are linearly independent over the field of algebraic numbers, and this is joint work with Kumar. So what are the future directions that this research can take? The first question that arises, and I think some experts in transcendental number theory and Baker's theory are sitting here, so you can perhaps shed some light on this. The idea would be to develop a Baker theory for dilogarithms of algebraic numbers and more generally polylogs, and I'd really like to know from the experts what the obstacles are for something like this. The other question that emerges from this investigation is to understand the relationship of the multiple zeta values and the special values of the Riemann zeta function. So we know, for example, this classical theorem of Euler that says zeta 3 is really the same as zeta 2 comma 1, you know, that we know. So the question is, we try to come up with more and more relations, and all these shuffle and stuffle relations are trying to explain that. So can you kind of distill all the new values that are coming into the picture? Can you kind of boil all the new transcendental numbers that are emerging in these special values of multiple zeta values? Can you kind of boil them all down and tell me what are the new transcendental numbers? Because there could be so lots of relations. And in fact, the first step toward this direction was taken this year by Francis Brown, who showed that the vector space of multiple zeta values of weight m is actually spanned by zeta a1 to ak, with the ai's either being 2 or 3. 1, 2, or 3. No, 2 or 3, sorry. 2 or 3, yes. So this is an amazing theorem. And I believe, now I haven't checked this, but I think if you work out the dimension of all those things, it still doesn't match the dimension of the space. So there must be, are you sure? Yeah. It matches? Okay. Matches. Okay. Well, there you go then. So we, the conjecture is that they're, okay, all right. Pardon me? 2 or 3. Okay. Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Okay. So would you, is the conjecture also that they're algebraically independent?
Yeah.
No, okay, linear, but not algebraically independent. Okay. All right. So the next thing is to try to develop a theory of multiple zeta values with twists. And this has not been really well researched. And the idea here is to you look at just as you would look at multiple zeta values. So in the multiple zeta value case, you're looking at n1 bigger than n2 bigger than nk, 1 over n1 to the a1, 1 over nk to the ak. So here, what we would like to do is perhaps put numbers here of this type. I mean, you can't put any old numbers, but some sort of characters. No, sorry. Yeah. So you would put and I think the easiest thing to start from is to make sure that these are roots of unity and somehow investigate special values and relations that might exist between these, and then try to see what possible relations there can be for the vector space spanned by such special values, and try to relate them to special values of classical Dirichlet L series, and then to come up with an analog of Brown's theorem in the context of these multiple L values. So that's basically all I had to say, and thank you very much.